This is a Jerry Pippin special report. We've all heard the sound of a flying saucer landing, in the movies at least. Many movies since the 1950s have had the sound of a flying saucer coming to land. But in real life, it has happened, evidently, to many people. And it was not as exciting as the movies. It was terrifying. They came, they saw, and they take. Abductions. E.T. abductions. That's the subject of our show tonight. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and tonight we had the first of two specials in July, and we'll follow up with another special or two in the fall and winter. E.T. abductions, a fascinating concept, something that has been around the UFO business for a while, but we really never have been able to really pin it down exactly. The first abduction that I know about was Benny and Barney Hill back in 1960-something, but it's been going on for a long time. Exactly what is going on? That's the question. And we're going to examine that tonight with a panel of experts, and that'll be coming in with a very interesting show. And the same thing for July 25th, when we'll have a new show with a different panel of experts and a different group of people who have been abducted. There is no shortage of people who are willing to talk about this subject. If you're one of them and you'd like to get on the show or at least contact us and give us your story, feel free to write me an email at jerry@jerrypippin.com. In a moment, we're going to talk to Rita Pellegrina Freeman. She's had several abduction experiences, including experiences that led her to believe that she was used to develop hybrids by the ETs. She describes in detail to me the place where these things happen, where half-human, half-alien beings are kept in a warehouse-type facility. She talks about the different species of ETs as well. These are first-hand accounts of those that she has encountered, including reptilians and huge insect-like creatures. That'll be coming up in a moment, so stay tuned. You're listening to our abduction special on the Inception Radio Network.
Rita Pellegrina Freeman, and you're actually from El Paso, right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your experience. You were in a book, actually, your experience. Why don't you tell a little bit about that first for our listeners?
Okay.
What was the name of the book, and who was the guy that wrote it or whatever?
The name of the book is The God Hypothesis, and it's written by who used to be our MUFON director in El Paso, Texas. His name is Joe Lulz, who was a PhD in communications at our University of Texas at El Paso.
And why did he write about your experience? What happened about that? First of all, are you still a MUFON? Do you still go to the meetings?
We had a wonderful El Paso MUFON group for a while, and now
it's kind of disappeared.
That's correct. That's correct. I guess persons have other issues to deal with.
Well, MUFON's coming back and forming, getting some meetings going. So maybe I've been invited to the one in Irving, Texas to speak. So maybe we'll make it to El Paso one day.
Yeah, we need our group again.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about, if we may, the experience you had and why it made the book.
I'm a person who grew up in El Paso, the Chamisal area, and since my first conscious recollection of an abduction was at age eight, when my friends, my brothers and sisters, were out in our backyard on a summer night, 1955. We had this object come overhead, and I remember the kids looking up at it, And after a while, I felt this electricity go through my body. At that moment, I saw my brothers and sisters and friends, my neighbor's kids seemed to be frozen in place. Next thing I know is that I'm being lifted off the ground, and I'm looking down, but I can't move. I can't talk. I can't run. I'm scared.
Well, I'd be scared, too.
I'm taken into this craft, mm-hmm. and that is my first experience. And I said, there were witnesses.
And you were very young at the time.
I was about 8 years old. This was about 1955.
And when you got into this craft, what happened? Do you remember?
Well, I remember I was very scared. I didn't know where I was or what was going on. After that night, I didn't remember anything else. The only thing that I was told, because my family later on told me that I was gone that night and didn't reappear in my backyard till about 4 o'clock in the morning, the following morning.
They must have been worried sick.
The other kids who saw what happened to me called their parents out of their homes, and the whole neighborhood was out looking for me, and everybody was pointing to the sky that something came and took me. And my mother held me, and what I had in my leg was like an incision mark, a scar that I still have on my leg, where it looks as if somebody took a sharp instrument, went in my, like, over my ankle, mm-hmm. where somebody put in a sharp instrument, did an oval, and extracted tissue, because I remember that was the day that I said, I want to, when I grow up, figure out what happened to me, because I can look into my leg and I can see a hole there. I can see the bone in my ankle where tissue has been removed, but there's no blood and there's no pain, and it healed by itself. So I know something happened to me.
Now, you know, 8 years old, you're fairly young at that time. Of course, this made a big impression on you. You'd remember it even then. But do you have any recollection of what happened to you on the craft?
The only thing I remember is that I was taken at that time. After I came back, and my mother and the neighborhood kids and people around there looked at me, they said that my eyes were swollen. I felt like as if I had been, I guess we now refer to it as being drugged, like I had anesthesia, mm-hmm. that feeling. Mm-hmm. I could not talk. People would ask me, what happened to you? I was too exhausted. The next day and the next day and the next day, I was sick. I was physically ill. And as time went on and my parents and my friends wanted, what happened to you when they took you? I could not remember. There was a period of what I would feel would be amnesia. And it wasn't until I was an adult, or a young adult, I started looking into the UFO field for answers.
Did you have dreams about that, did you recall more? In other words, later on,
I had that experience at age 8, and then later on, I remembered experiences at age 13. I was taken by this group, and that's when I saw the hybrids, what we refer to as the hybrids. And then I had experiences at age 16, 17, 19, and on.
Yeah, have you had any recently, or just when you were early in your 20s and on down?
It wasn't until the age of about 26, 30, when I think that things seemed to level off. I was left with what people refer to as psychic abilities. But even as a young child, I could talk to animals, to plants, mental telepathy. Those things became part of my life, and I attribute those to the ET experience.
Now, in your later abductions or contacts, whichever way you want to refer to it, and how do you refer to it? How do you think about it yourself? Was it friendly or unfriendly?
It was very frightening when it first started out as a child. I didn't understand what was going on. And when they take you, they try to teach you things. I was not a good student with them. I fought them.
When they try to teach you things, what do you mean? They gave you lessons about things or what?
Yeah. In the book that Joe Luce wrote, and also in presentations that I have done in my hometown and also once in Mexico City, I speak about the ETs taking me to other worlds.
And you literally went to another world, or do you think they? I mean, tell us a little bit about that, if you can, or does it bother you to talk about it?
The whole experience to me was difficult emotionally, and there's physical aspects that you have to deal with, the examinations, and the fact that you are part of what people refer to in the UFO community as a hybridization
mm-hmm.
project, the breeding of hybrids.
Yeah, and you think that happened to you?
I know it did.
So you have a hybrid offspring? Or do you know?
Was shown the hybrids at age 13, and that's when I knew that that's what they were doing with my body. New life was being created by them for whatever reason, and I had to accept this as that the ETs were taking part of who I was for whatever else they were working on. But I did not develop like a bond between myself and what would be referred to as my children. I always understood that I belonged as a human being in El Paso, Texas, and the hybrids were meant for some other purpose, and I accepted that.
And have you ever figured out what the hybrids were meant for? That's one of the big riddles, I think.
That's true. Basically, I got the understanding that there's some plan and that the new life was being created. I was given the impression that there was some type of a population problem with the ETs and that they were trying to solve a problem through the hybrids.
What kind of characters or beings were these ETs? Were they always the same type?
I remember that when you're taken, you're escorted by what I guess I refer to as a small grace. And as a young child and being frightened by these experiences, I always was very physically combative.
When you're physically combative, how did they react? Did they hurt you or just?
The little graced, and for the better part, are harmless. They're just there to bring you to the craft, do mm-hmm. the procedures, and basically they do what they need to do. But because of my lack of cooperation, I was disciplined by, on some occasions, from other beings that are referred to, I guess, reptilian in nature. I also remember specifically a being that looked to me like a 7-foot-tall grasshopper, or what is called the praying mantis type.
So you actually have seen several types.
Yes, and the praying mantis type, I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw this, because that's what they look like. But this being talked with me, mental telepathy, and he explained to me that there were things that needed to be done, and if it would help if I cooperated, and he told me that, that I could learn things from them.
Now, when the reptilians disciplined you, what did they do? I mean,
the reptilians were physically present at a lot of my experiences. They tend to be really rough mentally and physically on you. They seem to not have a sensitivity
situation. Yeah, did they twist your arms or push you around or beat you or what?
They do procedures, and they do them without regard to your I can't say they tortured me or beat me, but their attitude towards you feel you feel a very aggressive their aggressiveness towards you.
In other words, they didn't have a very good bedside manner.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about what the reptilians look like. When, were they tall, 5 feet, 6 feet, varying sizes? Or do you remember?
Well, I know the small grays. They're 3 feet, 4 feet, whatever. Mm-hmm. These other individual reptilian, tall. This is when I was a child.
Okay.
So we're talking tall, 5 feet, 6 feet, very muscular.
With skin that what? Looks like a reptile? Is that the reason we call them reptilians?
They have features that you wonder about, kind of like a snake and a lizard at the same time. Skin is...
Scaly?
Oh, yeah.
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 And now,
and the eyes, kind of like cat eyes.
It pierced right through you, huh?
The yellow cat eyes is
okay.
The way I refer to it.
Now, as you got older, who did you run across? Were there still reptilians, or were there more of other types of beings, or do you remember? I'm thinking in terms of, you know, you said you're 18, 19, 20, something like that. You ought to be able to remember more, maybe not, I don't know.
For the most part, as a young adult, they frightened me so much that I requested that whenever I was with them that I not remember too much about their physical appearance because it always upset me. So
they were able to cloud men's minds.
Like blurry, when I looked at them, kind of like blurred, at least in my memory. I don't have specifics other than the first time I saw them. It was too rough on me, and I told them that I needed...
You got the impression that they took you somewhere else,
yes,
right?
Yes, sir, yes.
Did you have an idea where it was?
In my presentation, I speak about three different worlds that I was taken to because, as strange as it might sound, I got to get to like these guys. They were really rough, and it's a physical, mental strain on you. However, I felt that they were very intelligent beings and that there were many things to learn, and I would ask questions and they would give me answers.
They would actually answer you
and
weren't necessarily condescending or anything. They would actually have a discussion with you.
Yes, and they would ask me if I wanted to go on trips with them, and I would say yes. For a while there, I said, hey, you know, this is so wonderful. Other place. This is unusual, but I had a curious mind, and I got to trust them somewhat.
I can understand that. So where did you go? Do you know?
I remember a world where the inhabitants are in water. They live underwater. I don't know if this was Earth. I believe it was in a different, wholly different location. Where the inhabitants are like half fish, half human.
Wow. Did they communicate by telepathy or these people? I'm trying to figure out how a half fish, half human would talk.
The ETs I was with could communicate with them, and they interpret to me the questions I had.
Did they make sounds?
No, they had feelings for some some way. There's a way of understanding through feeling.
This is Jerry Pippin, and we have Rita Pellegrino Freeman, and she has been abducted several times, has an incredible story to tell, actually feels that she was a parent of a hybrid. Did those hybrids look anything like you?
In the UFO literature, you see a lot of pictures that other women have drawn of what they feel are their hybrid children. They tend to be small, tiny, little hair. They look fragile.
You really didn't identify with the...
They're not human. There are aspects of them that you would refer to as human. But certainly their physical construction, I don't think, is meant to function in our physical world.
Now, we talked about the half fish, half man or type. There are other worlds you went to, too.
I was really very happy to meet other life forms who had, I was under the impression that they had adjusted to this water environment as a result of problems on their own planet. They had to go into the water because they could no longer be outside on the surface because of some harmful energies. So they had to go into the water, and they adapted into the water,
yes,
and became happy there. They have good lives there. They live with what we refer to as marine animals, and they have communities. As a matter of fact, this group mentioned to me that they prefer to be left alone. They're content.
Now, the other world she went to?
There was a world where I guess we refer to them as light beings, human form, but not real physical. And they didn't walk, they levitated. And there were not sexual, male, female having children. There were no children. There were just, there were males and females, but there was like an exchange of energy for food because they didn't need food. They exchanged energy. But their purpose, what I was told, is that they were volunteers in this environment, and their job was to take care of worlds, take care of plants and animals that had been brought to them from other worlds that had problems, and they were there to be like rehabbed and then mm-hmm. distributed to other locations when the time came.
Now, you said there was a third world?
The third place where I was taken was a place where I have to refer to as an insect world. I remember as we approached this planet was also an underground environment in which it seemed as if we were like in a bee honeycomb structure, what we know as how the bees live in their structures with honeycomb.
Mm-hmm.
These were insects who lived in this type of this environment, and actually they had domesticated other insect-type beings, and they lived together. And this was the insect world that I visited.
Now, all of a sudden, these abductions stopped, is that right?
When I was 17, 18, 19, I was in Marine Corps. I'm a former Marine. I was stationed Parris Island, South Carolina. I had abduction experiences there. I had an experience where I was told that we probably would not be seeing each other anymore. I suspect they were telling me this is the conclusion of my part of being hybrid
right,
project.
Your usefulness.
Yeah,
basically. So had you connected with anybody during this time? I guess you said you liked some of them after a while.
I had to learn to trust them because whenever they took me and I wanted to learn more and they took me to different places, I had to trust that they'd bring me back in good health.
When they take you away like that, were you gone for long periods of time, or was it just a matter of hours?
We're talking hours, and I suspect probably into days. Apparently, they have the ability to where they can take you from a situation, and you're gone with them for a long period of time, but they're able to bring you back into almost the exact moment from which they took you. So a lot of times, people around you may not even detect that you were gone, but you know that you were.
Well, Lita, I really appreciate you stopping by and telling us your story. And how has it felt after 5 years to come back to a UFO conference like that? Is it a good feeling, or is it bringing up bad memories or whatever?
It's a mixture. I'm trying to make the positive side of this experience, and one of it is that I, as an adult, have answered the question that I had when I was a child and I saw this scar on my leg. What happened to me? I know that it's something that happens to others, and that there are many important and very intelligent persons wanting answers to this type of phenomena.
How many hybrids do you think you were a parent to?
I saw like what would be a warehouse or a huge warehouse of hybrids in glass containers, what I refer
were
to.
Were they alive?
Yes, it's kind of like what the Japanese did in some experiments. They were growing tomato plants in water, hydroponics, mm-hmm. and this is what it looked to me, except this were containers of living fetuses growing in cylinders and being kept in shelves, hundreds of shelves in like a warehouse area.
We could go on and on and on here. Our time's almost up, but I have to ask you, you don't have any maternal feelings for these hybrids? I mean, you know, like you said, they really weren't human.
I had to accept the fact that there was a reason for this new life and that this new life was meant to live elsewhere. And any emotional attachment I had, I could not interfere with this plan.
You personally don't believe the hybrids are among us, walking in the street, working at McDonald's, selling Fords down the street or whatever.
I don't have an answer for that.
Okay, thank you very much, Rita, and good luck.
And with that question, Rita shook her head and got up from the table. It was just too emotional for her, as she had dropped by our booth in Roswell, New Mexico. We have more abduction scenarios and some very interesting observations by some experts in the field coming up. By the way, if you'd like to hear other interviews like Rita's on demand on our website, simply go over to UFOshows2go.com. That's UFO Shows and the number 2, togo.com. Stay tuned. Our abduction special is next.
And come up to my shoulder and slender and darker.
The color here.
Oh, yeah.
Mean
cold. Looks like a dentist's office.
And what makes it look like a dentist's office?
Everything comes out of the walls and hoses. I don't like it here.
There were beings around me. They were little short beings, but fairly chubby and heavy on the beings. And there was about four or five of them. And they were busy doing different things as I was laying on the table. And then I got to here, and there was a little man standing right there. Right there by where you are, pretty much right there. But he was really short, and he had on like a silver suit. I think it was like a dark silver suit, maybe grayish suit. And he had a really large head. He was only like to here.
It just gradually settled down in the field. And at that point, I panicked. And I shut off all the lights, and I went upstairs, and I hid in the corner of the bedroom. And as I told you, I sat there for what seemed to be no more than a minute or two. And then I woke up in the morning. I obviously lost the time because I don't know how I got in bed anymore, and I lost the whole night.
And now, the Inception Radio Network presents a special feature presentation, Alien Abduction Roundtable Confessions, with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Extraterrestrial abductions. Just the name of it makes people think and wonder what's going on. We've wanted to do a show like this for a long time. Hi, I'm Jerry Pippin, and let me run down what we're going to do tonight. We have a moderator, and that's me, and we have a panelist, and that's Elaine Douglas. And Elaine Douglas is well-known in the business of UFOs. She's the board editor of JAR, J-A-R, and that's a magazine about abductions. She's been a UFO researcher since 1985. She was the MUFON state director for Utah. And she's no stranger to any of our listeners on a regular basis. She also was in Washington, D.C. for many years and was involved in the government in the military affairs. I believe she went to MIT and we'll talk maybe about that a little bit as well with her. In the 1990s, she was organizer for the Operation Right to Know, which is known as ORTK, an organization which it really, I guess the best way to phrase it, is protesting with the public against UFO secrecy. She holds a master's degree from MIT, as I alluded earlier, and it's in military policy. And let's welcome her to the show. Elaine, good to have you on the line from Utah.
Jerry, good afternoon. How are you?
Okay. Now, I've wanted to do a show with you for a long time about abductions, and you've been interested in it forever, almost, as I heard the resume.
That's right.
Bio, as I talked about it. How did you get interested in that?
Well, Jerry, right from the beginning, I mean, it's important to study sightings, and I've studied lots of sightings, and looked into the question of the technologies that the UFOs are using. But what's really important to me is the question, who's in these craft? You know, who's inside these craft, and what are they doing, and what do they want? That's what's important as far as I saw that at a very early point in UFO research for myself.
Now, and so have you had an abduction experience yourself?
No.
Reason I ask is, usually somebody, it's a defining a moment. Don't you agree when people suddenly realize that perhaps something like this has been happening?
Well, some people have said to me, well, you must, Elaine, have had abduction experiences. You're so interested in abductions. I say to them, look, you got to be brain dead if you have the slightest inkling that extraterrestrials are operating on this planet, abducting people, taking them out of their homes and dealing with them in very intrusive ways, and you're not absolutely riveted to that subject, you know, you must be brain dead. So I don't think you have to have had the experience. You remember that old saying from Ernest Hemingway, for whom the bell tolls?
When we talk about some of these things, I think probably the best thing we need to do, first of all, if it's okay, if you're laying this, is talk about that magazine, JAR. What's that stand for?
Well, JAR is the Journal of Abduction and Counter Research. We're at jarmag.com, and we've been publishing. It's an online magazine. It's only $20 a year, and it has good, high-quality articles about the abduction phenomenon. It's we sent it to you in a PDF format to subscribers, and the current issue is JAR 9. That's our 9th issue. It's free, and if they go to jarmag.com, we'll send you a free issue with some very dynamite articles in it.
How often does that come out?
Well, irregularly, unfortunately. That's one of my falling down places, is that I have trouble being regular about anything, and as you know, I've been researching MUFON for the past several months, and I'm afraid I've let JAR lapse, but I have no intention, you know, none of us do who's on JAR has any intention of dropping the publication. We're definitely going back to it.
Now you mentioned MUFON, and that was one of your concerns about MUFON. You and I have talked about it on the air and off the air, is that you feel that somebody is leaking information to either the government itself or some company working under contract with the government to show up and find out about these abductions before anybody else does. And you were very alarmed about that. Did I phrase that basically one of your concerns?
I mean, if MUFON were sending the names and addresses of abductees to the U.S. government, that would be dreadful, and it would expose abductees who are already innocent victims of a profound kind of harassment to further harassment from the U.S. government. Because you see, what we've come to understand, Jerry, is there's a thing called MILABS, military abductions. We've come to understand that the cover-up, the U.S. intelligence community is very, very interested in the abductions. for the very reasons that, of course, I suppose I'm interested in them. I'm not surprised the U.S. government's interested in them, but what we have to understand is that there's a big struggle going on here between the aliens and the government, I think. And people are just expendable in this context. If the government is interested in you as an abductee, they're not interested in your welfare. They're interested in finding out what the aliens are doing with you and what's happening with you between you and the aliens. They're not interested in making you comfortable or safe necessarily. It's just a very disturbing situation.
Well, now when and you've talked to many, many abductees, and I've done many shows on it, and it appears to me, and maybe you've been getting the same information or maybe not, I'd like to have you comment on it, but it appears to me that the federal government is coming right along after these abductions and doing the same thing.
Yes, that's what I was talking about, military abductions, my so-called MILABS, military abductions. And all that refers to the extent to which the U.S. government is studying the abductees and trying to duplicate with their own experimental subjects the techniques that the aliens are applying to the abductees. The U.S. government is trying to duplicate it and implement their own efforts in the same directions. And that doesn't surprise me. You were kind enough to mention that I went to MIT and studied military policy. Well, one of the things you understand we need to understand about the military or the government as a whole is if they think they're facing an adversary, then they study the adversary's weapons and try to duplicate them and find out how to counter those weapons. And if you think that the abductions are a weapon, I'm using the term loosely here, if you're the U.S. government, you see what's going on, then you say to yourself, we have to understand these techniques that are being used on our people, and we have to have them too, and know how to implement and manipulate and use these same techniques. That is what they would think. And that is what I think I see them doing. And that is what I think my labs represent. So in the meantime, probably we need to ask ourselves what the abductions represent. And David Jacobs, a renowned abduction researcher from Pennsylvania, observed early on that the abductions are not an experimental program that the aliens are doing, much less an observational program. It's not a program in which they're just kind of dickering around and seeing what makes humans tick. The abductions are, from what we can observe, they're a developed operational program that the aliens are implementing. They've already done all their experiments, and they've now got this program in full swing. And it's a program, when you study it, it's got momentum, intensity, and the whole abduction scenario that the aliens are implementing, it just cries out purpose, goal, direction. You know, it's something that they're doing with great intensity and seriousness. The abductions of human beings in the millions all over the planet.
Yeah, we had at one time one of our produced intros on our show that is a percentage of people who think they've been abducted, and it turns out to be about 7 million or maybe more.
Well,
how many do you think we're talking
about?
The only figure
that I have that I know of that is reliable, I suppose it's reliable, I think it is, it's the most reliable, would be the Roper poll of 1992, which found, at that time, 3.7 million abductees. That's what the estimate was from the sampling they did. And it's really, if you're an abduction researcher, the only thing you can say about how many abductions there are is a lot. Okay, there's a lot. If you wanted to be an abduction researcher, you would have no trouble locating people who've had these experiences and to study them, if that's what you wanted to do. There's a bunch, a whole bunch. And Jerry, you might say, what does this consist of? So, okay, it's a program with momentum and intensity and purpose and goal. So what are they doing? I've tried to sum this up so many times. The way I describe it today is the abductions are a set of techniques for obtaining complete control over a human being. The foundation of it is technological implants, tiny little devices that we find abductees have inserted all over their bodies, including in their brains and every other part of their body you want to name. We can give you an example of an individual who appears to have, or even an object has been recovered from their limbs, their feet, you know, their groin, their mouth, their nose, their eyes, their brain, their ears. This is technology, which I believe without this technology, these implants, I call it wiring. I say the abductees are wired. Without that, I don't believe that the aliens could control people. I think that's a requirement for their control. And then layered on top of that, Jerry, is behavior modification. And it starts in infancy. It starts in certainly early childhood. And there's a lot of different protocols that are employed, and we don't understand what the difference is between some of these protocols. For example, just a gross example would be some people are abducted like every 6 years. Some people are abducted 3-4 times a week. And what's the difference between one of those people and the other people? The ones who are abducted 6 times every 6 years, we don't know. But there's a big variation. Yet, all are implanted, all have this behavior modification. And what's the behavior modification about? Well, okay, I'll wait for you to ask me that question.
Now, when we talk about abductions and these, wide swing of experiences, some are abducted fairly often, as you alluded to, and others not so often.
Right.
It almost sounds like it's a scientific experiment, like we do on the animals, but at the same time, I believe many of the abduction researchers I've talked to think it's a little more nefarious than that. It's a little more sinister. What do you think?
Well, that's what I was alluding to, that it's, I don't call it experimental or observational. It's, they know what they're doing. They're not experimenting with what they're doing. They know what they're doing, and they've got a goal and a purpose, and they're pursuing it with great intensity. And so then the question comes up, you know, what's the goal? What's the behavior modification? What's that all about?
We're gonna talk about some specific cases here as we go along tonight, Elaine. I'd like to get you to have your comments about them as well. Peter Davenport's on the highway up in Washington State, but I think we're going to make a contact to him fairly shortly, another 5 minutes or so. And we always think of Peter Davenport, Elaine, as, reporting UFO sightings. But he's interested in abductions too, right?
Well, he has a tremendously important case that he's going to talk about, I hope. It's this case of Pennsylvania, 2002. Mr. Todd Sees, who...
Yeah, we visited with him briefly last night, and he's going to bring that up, and that's a case that's very interesting. Actually, when we talk about abductions, I guess it all goes all the way back to Betty and Barney Hill, and basically they take you on aboard a ship, and they examine you to all other sorts of things. What are some of the most unusual abduction stories you've heard? I mean,
the question of when these abductions began is very important. And Dave Jacobs, to mention him again, he seems to feel that they began in the very late 19th century. And what we see is that, of course, it's well known about the multi-generational abductee families where an abductee can tell you that their grandmother had these stories and their parents had these stories and they have stories and their children have stories and maybe their grandchildren have stories. One of the differences between those generations is that those earlier generations never were brought into conscious awareness by the aliens of what was going on. But today we see a different protocol. In other words, let's say your grandmother, Jerry, if she was an abductee, she never would have really become aware of it. She might have had strange stories that she could tell of unusual things that happened, but she never would have really understood it. And nor would your mother, in all likelihood, if she had been an abductee. But if you were, then something else would be going on, which is going on today. And that is, the aliens are awakening the abductees and forcing them to become consciously aware of the presence of the ET in their lives. And people are being woken up on purpose by the aliens. And that seems to be part of the unfolding purpose.
So you're saying that they're actually behind this this movement where we're finding out about abductions? In other words, they're giving more or less a silent consent, or maybe a little more active than that, and actually...
Yes, you're right. You're right on target. You're suggesting that we found out about the abductions because the aliens wanted us to find out about them. That's what I think you're saying, and that's what I believe it to be the case. They want us to know about it. And as we learn about it, we learn that for the most part, there is nothing we can do about it. See, in other words, when they want you to find out something about them, they also want you to find that out. They want you to find out that they're doing any doggone thing they want to do, and there won't be anything that you can do about it. See, that's the corollary that you're supposed to learn.
Okay, we are going to go ahead and take some phone calls here and get to Peter Davenport in a minute as well. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Jerry. It's Janet Saylor.
Hey, Janet. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine.
I hear your conference is beginning to get a little action up here in Taos. When is that?
Yeah, it sure is. Been on the phone all day.
Good. That's actually, I guess, the 25th of October through the 30th.
Yep,
and,
you
have some abductees. I think you have some subjects this year about that. Don't you?
Stephen Jones,
when we call him an abductee?
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about. I think there's maybe more than one kind of abduction. And I don't know that Elaine and I have really discussed this, but I'm learning from people who, especially some who are going to be speakers at this year's event, that there are apparently some benevolent abductions as well as some nasty ones. And I know the nasty ones are really awful. We've had some of those people at previous symposiums, like Niara Heisley, for instance. Stephen Jones has been abducted, and he's contacted all the time, and he doesn't feel threatened by his experiences. On the other hand, Travis Walton, who was at our symposium last year and is going to be back again this year in kind of a different context, he was very threatened. I'm kind of hoping some of these guys will call in a little while so we can have a discussion about it.
They probably will. Elaine, what do you think about that? Do you agree with Janet or not?
Oh, absolutely. She's quite right. And for many people, the abductions are a source of wonder and curiosity, and I would ask Janet this. Janet, suppose some unknown people came to your house and kidnapped you and took you out for a steak dinner and showed you a great movie and then delivered you back to your house. Would you be concerned? You know, would you be concerned? In other words, first of all, the underlying issue is not whether you have a good time or you don't have a good time. The aliens are perfectly capable of showing you a good time. the underlying issue is this: you're being taken against your will by an unknown force for purposes that you do not understand. And there's, in my book, there's no way to get comfortable with something like that.
Well, I agree. If any, the word that you use is, they kidnapped me, and anybody who kidnaps me is not okay with me, regardless of whether they give me a steak dinner, which I should be so lucky. But I think sometimes, at least from some of the people I'm speaking with and working with, is that they come to believe, or they come to feel differently about their abductors, and there's really no other word for them. You're right about that. They come to feel differently about them once they are assured of, for lack of a better term, a benevolent agenda. I agree. I don't think anybody should be kidnapping anybody. On the other hand, is it always kidnapping? I mean, some of the people I've been talking to tell me they've been contacted first, and I think there's a distinction between contact and abduction.
Sometimes
they overlap, but sometimes they don't.
If you want to look at just the technical aspects of it, the abductions are a set of things by which the aliens communicate with you and do what they want with you. It is not always limited to they come and take your physical body. Sometimes they come and take your non-physical body. Sometimes they don't take your body at all, or physical or non-physical. Sometimes they just hang around in your house. Sometimes they just invade your dreams. Sometimes they provide you with visions. You name it. Sometimes they send strange creatures.
You know, Elaine and Janet, it seems to me that there's a lot of screen memories or something going on here that people don't really remember whether or not they had a good time or not. I mean, that seems like it's... they have the ability to implant those things. It's hard to tell reality.
There is a thing called screen memories, but I would not be one who would try to say that any abductor who said they had a good time on an abduction was laboring under a screen memory. No, having a good time is part of the whole picture. In other words, I mentioned behavior modification, and I've talked about goals. The goal is the capitulation of the abductee. The goal is to surrender. The abductee reaches a point when he is bonded, he ceases to resist, he embraces the alien purpose, and things go well from the alien's point of view, he begins to propagate it publicly. And one of the techniques they use is to alternate pleasant and unpleasant. That's just one of their disorienting techniques. They'll pick you up on Monday, and you'll be scared out of your mind and subject you to great pain. They'll pick you up on Friday, and you'll have a lovely time. And pretty soon your head is spinning back and forth. You don't know what the heck is going on with you. And you start to come up with ideas like, well, the good aliens picked me up on Friday because I had a good time, and the bad aliens picked me up on Monday because I had a rotten time.
But it could be the same ones.
And things like that. Or you'll come up with the idea, well, the government picked me up on Friday when I had a bad time, and it was the good aliens that picked me up on Monday the government picked me up when I had a bad time. In other words, you'll start to make these, what I think are non-valid distinctions between having a good time and good people and bad people. It's all the same people. And oh yes, I'm quite aware that they look different. You know, I'm quite aware that some of them are tall and some of them are short. Some of them have scales and some of them have smooth skin. Some of them have big eyes, some of them don't. Some of them have noses, etc. I'm well aware of all that. For example, if there were good aliens, why don't they stop the bad aliens? You know, because they don't. So what good are the good aliens if they can't stop the bad aliens? But you see, I never attach good or the word good or evil or bad to these creatures. They are moving forward according to their own interests. They're doing something that they want to do, that they need to do, have decided to do for their own purposes. And so I don't regard them as evil. I mean, I regard them as something that is out there that is coercing us and is some kind of a predator and pursuing its interests, which I don't believe for a nanosecond coincide with my interests or the interests of the human race.
Janet, we got to move on with other phone callers. I have Peter Davenport on the line on the highway someplace in Washington.
Can I ask Elaine one more thing before you go to
sure.
the next caller? I'm a little concerned about the fairness, and maybe in terms of alien abduction, there is no fairness. I don't know. But, you know, you mentioned, you know, it's kind of like saying that if the aliens, if there are good aliens, why aren't they stopping the bad aliens? It's kind of like asking, if we have a police force, why don't they stomp out all crime? You know, I'm not sure that's a fair kind of statement to make, and I'm not defending anybody. I'm just wondering if it's realistic to believe that, you know, the good can stomp out the bad, and whether or not you, it sounds like what you're saying is you view all abductions as being not good, and you're saying you didn't use the term good or bad, but yet you kept using the term. And you know, you and I have talked about this before, and we're not really very far away from each other in terms of agreeing. I just kind of like to clarify that I think there's a, even if we're talking about non-terrestrials here, we're talking about somebody from another planet, another solar system, another universe. I think it, at least in my human nature, I find it necessary to find a balance and a fairness, and curious about your take on that.
Well, okay, Janet, I'll let her make the statement, and then we'll go to Peter Davenport. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Yeah, great.
Okay. Go ahead, Elaine. You can answer her.
Jerry, Janet's a very talented promoter, and she puts on very successful conferences. People ought to pay attention to what she's doing and attend her conferences down in Taos, because they're very well-run, and they're terrific events. I think that the issue of why don't the good aliens stop the bad aliens, if we want to use those words, is important, because if the bottom line is that the abductions are taking place for highly questionable purposes, then it matters a great deal. In other words, if there is harm that can come to us, and it is coming to us, then that's what we have to be concerned about. If there's some aliens out there who don't intend to exploit us, it just kind of washes out of the equation, because the leading edge that we have to be concerned about is whether these aliens are exploiting us, and to me they are. And I think that these pleasant times that abductees always have with abductions from time to time are part of the conditioning that I mentioned.
Semantics is definitely a part of it, and I think also the Stockholm Syndrome is part of it. People held captive for a long time for bad people sometimes end up taking up for them. Peter Davenport, are you there?
I am here, Jerry and Elaine, and how nice to hear both your voices. How nice
it's
to be
great,
back.
Great to hear from you. You're on the highway, huh?
Well, I'm not on the highway. I was a little delayed, so I'm still at the center, the National UFO Reporting Center, and it's much more relaxed being able to appear as a guest, not driving at 60 miles an hour.
Yeah, so, that's what I was concerned about a little bit. Been the director of the National UFO Reporting Center since 1994.
That is correct.
And your UFO sightings cases are legend. We've referred to them regularly. You had a great website. You appear on several radio shows off and on giving sightings. And I find it pretty interesting that Elaine expressed to me that you're interested in the abduction phenomenon.
I am indeed. I'm interested in all aspects of the UFO phenomenon, and that tragically certainly seems to be one of them. I don't think we can rule it out, and Elaine and I were talking earlier today and have talked several times in the recent past. I tend to agree with her that the phenomenon is very real, all too real. I wish it were not, and it does concern me. Over the last 17 years, I've received a handful of very convincing reports that strongly suggest to me that the alien abduction phenomenon, or I prefer the term interaction over abduction, is certainly taking place.
And why do you want to call it interaction?
Well,
I kind of agree with you, by the way, but I'm just curious for your reason.
Yeah, I guess it's my training as a scientist, Jerry. I prefer interaction until we know more about the phenomenon. Abduction suggests that the aliens are somehow kidnapping human beings off this planet. What we don't know is whether those human beings go against their will, or in some occasions go willfully or communicate willfully. It's just a more neutral term that I think is appropriate until we know more about the phenomenon.
Now, when did you go to Washington State, 1992?
No, I went to University of Washington in the 70s and 80s as a grad student, but I was an undergrad at Stanford University down in Palo Alto, California.
Uh-huh. Yeah, aren't you from St. Louis or someplace like that?
Yeah, I was born and raised in the Midwest, and
yeah.
I'm a show-me lad, and I think that may reflect in how I approach the UFO phenomenon, because I'm one of those people who needs evidence and hopefully proof, because there's a lot of claims, there are a lot of representations being made in the UFO community that don't seem to bear out. And I like to see evidence. It's the scientist in me combined with having been born in Missouri.
Yeah, and your reputation, of course, precedes you. And one of the things I remember more than anything else about the Peter Jennings special, the late Peter Jennings, was he was quite taken by you. You guys became friends.
Well, we had an opportunity to communicate on a couple of occasions. I always liked Peter Jennings. I liked his style in his presentation of the news. Turns out, as I read his background, I realized that he had been in Beirut, Lebanon, back in 1962 or 63, at the same time I was just down the pike in Ethiopia, the capital city of Addis Ababa. And I never got to Beirut. Who knows, we might have crossed paths at the embassy there if I'd been up there, but in any event, Peter Jennings and I were in the same neck of the woods way back when, 50 years ago or so.
You and I talked briefly about this case in Pennsylvania, and we covered, I think, at one time on a UFO sighting show, a little bit about that. Why don't you tell our audience about this is probably one of the most unique abduction cases ever. I don't even know if we'd call it an abduction case.
And yeah. Not only unique, but tragic, if indeed it's UFO-related, Jerry. But
Elaine, yeah, I mean, they found the fellow dead in a tree or something. Go ahead and tell the story.
Yeah. Well, this is an incident that takes us back to a Sunday morning about 5 a.m. It was the 4th of August, 2002, so about 9 years ago. A gentleman, age 39, left his home to drive several miles up to his family property on Mount Montour in central South Pennsylvania. It's in Northumberland County, Pennsylvania.
That's a pretty remote area, right?
That's my understanding. It is.
Yeah, I haven't been there either.
And I think the Susquehanna River flows through there. Very good trout fishing, of course, legendary for trout fishing, and I'll come back to that point in a moment. Elaine and I were discussing this point over prior days because she found it very interesting as well, and I sent her a short 5 or 6 page synopsis of what I knew in September of 2002. But what we do
Elaine's on the line with us here, so Elaine, you can react as well.
Hello, Peter.
Hi, Elaine. And
the part about that first report you got where the people were fishing on the river and they saw a disc with a man.
Yeah, he's getting ready to explain it to us.
Yeah.
And interestingly, it points up how important it is to post even suspicious reports such that the public may know about them, because when I first received the report about what allegedly had taken place there, I, for some reason, did not pay attention to it. But what we know is that Mr. Sees left his home at about 5 a.m. on an all-terrain vehicle, a little four-wheel drive vehicle, to drive several miles up to his property on Mount Montour to scout out populations of deer in preparation for the Colorado deer hunting season. Well, that, so far as I am aware, was the last time that Mr. Sees was seen alive. When he had not returned to his family's home, his wife asked her son, and Mr. Sees' son, to go up to the property and find out what Dad was doing and why he was late. Well, his son apparently, I think I have the story correct here, went up onto Mount Montour to the family property, and he found the all-terrain vehicle. He found his father's outer, apparently hunting garments, neatly folded and lying on the back of the ATV, but he could not find his father. Well, the son returned to the home and reported this to his mother, and the police were contacted. The police went up onto Mount Montour. They, too, could not find Mr. Sees, and so a search party was mounted. Well, before the day was over, they had an estimated 200 people involved in searching for Mr. Todd Sees. They had, I'm told, helicopters, people on vehicles, people on horseback, and people on foot scouring Mount Montour. Now, the interesting part of this, and this is what Elaine alluded to just a moment ago about the first report that I received, because what I've just recounted, I was not aware of until many weeks after the incident had occurred, but the National UFO Reporting Center received a written report over our online report form submitted by a gentleman who wished to remain anonymous, but he described himself as a farmer, and he said that three fishermen floating down, I think it was the Susquehanna River, were witness that morning, or actually he got the date incorrect. He said on the 6th of August, that would have been a Tuesday morning, but I believe it was the 4th of August, this farmer and four fishermen allegedly were witness to a metallic-looking disc-shaped craft hovering over Mount Montour. And he further goes on to say that this craft appeared to be connected to the top of the mountain by what we would call a shaft of light, like a flashlight or something along those lines, a laser, and a man's body clad only in undergarments was being floated up that shaft of light towards the disc. Well, I would give a lot of money to be able to talk to that farmer or the person who submitted that report. I don't know who it was. But I posted that report even though I was probably a little skeptical, even if I had read it. Well, several weeks later, I got a very angry email from an anonymous party, except for an email address. Turns out that this woman was a nurse, and she said in a very short email, "Mr. Davenport, why are you not paying more attention to the Todd Sees case?" Well, I wrote back promptly and said, "I'm not paying attention to it because I don't know a thing about it. What can you tell me?" And back came an immediate response saying, "Oh, yes, you do. You posted a report to your website." And I went to the website, and lo and behold, there was the original report from the farmer and the fisherman that I had posted but had not made special note of. And that was the beginning of my investigation into this bizarre matter. What makes it so interesting is Mr. Sees was not found on Sunday, the day the search party was started. He was not; his remains were not found until Monday evening. They were found by his son, and to the best of our knowledge, the remains of the decedent, Mr. C's remains, were so grossly mutilated that not even his own son could recognize the remains as being those of his late father. Well, that was the beginning of what apparently was a very extensive investigation, and an investigation that was done very quietly by the local police, by, interestingly, the FBI was brought into the case, and by the local county coroner, Coroner Kelly, and trying to get facts out of any of them proved to be almost impossible. But we do know...
These remains were found in a tree.
Yes, thank you for pointing that out, Elaine. The remains of Mr. Sees were found in heavy underbrush or possibly in a tree, I don't know for sure, suspended above ground. There is an allegation, an assertion, that there was a type of metal object that was clamped somewhere to his body, I think to his upper arm, but I'm not sure. And days after his remains were found, after an autopsy had been performed, no results of the autopsy were published until many weeks later, probably 2 months later. The body allegedly was returned to the family for burial, although it was described to me that the coffin that was used, provided by the coroner, was a metallic coffin that not only was bolted shut, but allegedly it had been welded shut. So nobody could get into that coffin, and the family was forbidden by somebody to break into the coffin and see the remains. They were not even allowed to see the remains of Mr. Sees or have a physician serve as their family representative to do so. No positive.
And the funeral home just had to take their word for it. He was in that casket.
Exactly. And I talked to family members and delicately proposed that they might want to open the casket or have somebody view the remains. And I was roundly castigated by at least one member of the family, the niece of Mr. Sees, who did not want to hear any talk about the possibility that her father's death might have something to do with alien creatures or flying saucers. So that's where it stands. There are people who are still investigating the case, but I could not interest anybody at the time in late August and September of 2002, couldn't interest anybody, including MUFON, in investigating the case. So it was not until years later, after I had talked about it on your program, Jerry, and on many other radio programs, before people began to wake up and started to take interest in
that. Right. I remember when you first put that out, and we referred to it on one of our UFO sighting shows because it was so unusual. And, you know, I just kind of dismissed it later and at the time because it's a pretty incredible story. But hindsight, maybe we shouldn't have dismissed it, huh?
Well, I dismissed it, too.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that is so bizarre that it really doesn't capture your attention until you start getting more facts about what had taken place there.
Question.
Yes.
I have a question. Peter, exactly how did you get the impression that the body was mutilated?
That was reported to me in my first conversation with the nurse. And my recollection, Elaine, is that the body was first taken to the local hospital before it was taken to the coroner's office or the morgue. They may be one and the same. And this woman was on duty when she saw the remains when they were brought into the hospital.
And this was the woman who sent you the email and said, why aren't you investigating the murder of Todd C?
Exactly.
Yeah, have you heard from her since, Peter?
I have not. And I've had a computer crash. She, as I recall, she submitted a report to us as well, or an email, and that name has been lost. But I suspect that anybody doing a local investigation wouldn't have too much difficulty in finding out who this woman was. She was very mature-sounding, very eloquent. She was very forceful and seen to it that the case was pursued because she thought that something very, very unusual had happened there. And based on the information available to me, about the case, I tend to agree with her.
Well, maybe somebody listening up there will get in touch with us. And maybe we can follow it up more. Peter,
Peter, do you still have our email
address? Go ahead, Elaine.
Does he still have our email address?
No, I do not, Elaine. I have checked, and I may have it in an external hard drive backup system, but it's going to take more computer expertise than I have to be able to get that data out of it.
Yeah. Now, have either of you had other abduction stories similar to this at all?
I'll let Elaine speak. She's the more more extensively experienced in this field than I am, so I'll let her answer that.
Well, the thing that I noted about this this matter, if indeed the man was abducted, as it sounds like, from the initial report that he received, and if indeed he was mutilated, then what it is a human. It's just like the cattle mutilation, only it's a human being.
Exactly.
And the thing that I note about it is, let's just look at the cattle mutilations. The aliens don't have to leave those cattle around for people to find. They could take them off somewhere and just get rid of those mutilated bodies after they'd done whatever they want with them. But they drop them back on the ground just where you can find them. And this is a terrible intimidation tactic. I mean, you know, mafia groups and terror groups, what they do is they'll drop a dead animal at your door if they want to, you know, a dead dog or a dead cat at your door if they want to intimidate
you. Well, I mean, you know, logic would say one of two things. Either they think we're subhuman or sub-whatever they are, and they treat us like animals, or what I really think is, I'm not asking what do you guys endorse this, but I think there is an evil group out there.
Well, it's a political message. You know, it's another political message. We do whatever we want to do, and this is how dangerous we can be. So don't get any ideas, because we can be very dangerous. Yep. We know.
Peter, plug your website real quick, and we need people to go over there. Lots of people do it. You've been doing it a long time.
I have indeed, 17 years now. We've been here for 37 years. It's simply ufocenter.com. That's 9 letters, 1 word. UFOCENTER, UFOCenter.com, and we're just updating our website this afternoon. We posted 1,000 new reports last week, and we're posting another 175 this afternoon. So people might find some very, very interesting reports there. I myself had a very interesting sighting here in Eastern Washington State just 48 hours ago, and they can read my report on our website.
Can you give me a little thumbnail? My curiosity is killing me.
Yeah, I saw a fireball streak across the sky, Jerry. It was 6:42 p.m. Pacific time on Monday. That makes it the 17th of October. I stood there. The hackles just rose on the back of my neck. It was not a meteor. It was not a satellite. It was moving at about 5 times the rate that you see a satellite pass across the sky, and I'll let people read my description. It's about a full page description of what I saw.
Well, okay, well, they need to go over and read that. And you mentioned sightings reports. They seem to be up everywhere.
Yeah.
Lots more sightings.
I've been flooded with reports. We had a whole bunch of reports last night. South Dakota, Illinois, Colorado. I don't know what's causing them. Some of them may be cases of people who witnessed a blimp, an advertising blimp in Illinois. We're trying to get to the bottom of those sighting reports. But certainly this summer of 2011, I've never seen as many reports as I got this over the past 3 or 4 months. It's been very, very active.
Well, Peter, we're going to have to spend some time and do a show together. And Elaine, it's really great having you on. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back. I want to follow up when we come back. Elaine, maybe we'll get a Thomas Reed on. He He has a history of this in his family, and you alluded to that earlier as we discuss abductions. And we do expect phone calls from listeners, and we'd like to have basically some stories, some first-hand stories about abduction experiences. We'll be back in a moment. This is an abduction special. I'm Jerry Pippin. Elaine Douglas is with us. Peter Davenport, thanks for being here, too.
Been my pleasure, Jerry. And Elaine, thanks very much.
We'll talk to you later.
I'd like to take an opportunity here to talk to you about our websites. We've been adding programs and adding programs, and sometimes it's difficult to find what you're looking for. First of all, we have a search mechanism on each of our websites, and you can click, like if it's jerrypippin.com or if iPodshows.net, just search the websites, put in the name of what you're looking for, and it will come up. Check us out, won't you? Often.